I'm Christopher Lighton with the Palestinian medical doctor Mustafa Barghouti, advocate of a strong, nonviolent push to a two-state deal with Israel. His BDS campaign this spring in the world press and on American campuses stands for boycott, divestment, and sanctions to bring the pressure of international attention and law on the Israeli government. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Ask Palestinians why there is no Gandhi in their movement, and often the answer comes, but there are several, and Mustafa Barghouti should be recognized as one of them. Dr. Barghouti, the air is full of the tension between the Obama White House and the Bibi Netanyahu government, and in fact, a majority of people in Israel. Is there any comfort or promise in that for Palestinians?
Not at all. Because there is no comfort for us in having Netanyahu as the Prime Minister of Israel, because I believe there is no comfort for us, there is no comfort for the future even of Israelis themselves. This is a man who represents very extreme policies. This is a man who manipulates media constantly in a wrong way. And he is the one responsible for destroying the potential for peace based on two-state solution more than once. He was personally responsible in 1996 for undermining and destroying Oslo Agreement between Palestinians and Israelis. And he represents a major obstacle today because he heads a coalition of where actually the real majority is in the hand of the illegal Israeli violent settlers. So in a way, I think Netanyahu is bad news for us and bad news for Israelis and bad news for American administration. And we don't take comfort from that. We will have comfort when we see a different kind of prime minister that can make peace.
The general expectation seems to be impasse or worse, maybe even a third intifada. Roger Cohen in the New York Times yesterday quoted the troubleshooter George Mitchell saying that there's never been a U.S. president, including Bill Clinton, as focused and as committed on an Israeli-Palestinian resolution. But nobody foresees a lot of progress. Do you see a way forward now?
Absolutely, I do. I think we are talking about two different processes here. First of all, a different kind of American president, that for sure. I mean, and I recall when Obama was elected, for me it was a day of pleasure. Why? Because for me that was the day when Martin Luther King and his ideas succeeded in a way. And I remembered what Luther King said in one of his speeches in 68 about the dream he had that he would not probably see happen, and then it happens. To me, you see, I approach the issue of Palestine from a wider perspective than just looking at it as a pure nationalistic issue or an issue that relates to Palestinians. This is an issue of human justice. In that sense, to me, the Palestinian issue is not different from the case of Indians struggling for independence during Gandhi time, or Americans struggling against segregation during the time of segregation in the United States. In that sense, you can say that the election of Mr. Obama represented a very important step because this man comes from a background that allows him as American president to understand the injustice of the issue, how unjust it has been for Palestinians. On the other hand, he's educated. I mean, he's probably the most knowledgeable American president in office of what the Palestinian-Israeli issue is about. So that's one perspective of the issue, which makes him more capable of interfering and making, achieving results. But there is another aspect, and that doesn't matter who is sitting in that office. It relates to the fact that increasingly during the last decade, the Israeli policy, especially during Bush time, has become harmful to the American strategic interest in the region, in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in relationship.
This is the Petraeus warning.
Exactly. It's in relationship between United States as the biggest superpower or the only superpower and 1.5 billion people called the Muslims in this world, and Arabs, who are 340 million, and more than that, with many other people of this world who care about justice. In that sense, this combination is very interesting. Now, at the same time, Israel has one of the most powerful lobbies in the United States. And there is another strategic interest where Israel serves the American strategic interest of controlling the oil in the region and of maintaining dictatorship in the region instead of having true real democracy. And so that's why what you see today is a struggle inside the administration and a struggle in American policy. A struggle between those who want to see a change and between others who want to maintain business as usual. But there's a last factor, I'm sorry, and that is the fact that today in the United States, for the first time since decades, since years, the public in the United States is beginning to see how unjust the situation is for Palestinians. So there is a growing public opinion in schools, in universities, among intellectuals, greater awareness how unjust the Israeli policy has been.
Let's come back to that question of the American awareness, but I want to come back to three things you mentioned or alluded to about President Obama that completely fascinate me. You say he brings a peculiar sensitivity to justice. I wanted to take that apart between as a black American, his sensitivity on civil rights. I'm also intrigued by what you think he remembers, learns, and applies of his father's and grandfather's experience under colonialism in Kenya. But I'm also fascinated by what you mean when you say he knows the Palestinian-Israeli history and situation better than any president other than Clinton. How can you tell that? And where did he get it? On each of these points, I have to tell you, I'm still trying to figure the man out himself, his connection to civil rights, his connection to the colonial imperial history, and his mastery of those details.
Well, he's more knowledgeable for two reasons, probably. First of all, his age. He's young. So he's more exposed than the previous presidents to this issue. And he's more exposed in a way that is not like unilateral. But the second factor is that I know that he had courses with people who, like Edward Said and others, who he read things about the Palestinian-Israeli issue. And the way he handles the matter, the way he comes through, reflects the fact that he's clearly knowledgeable. I mean, he's different. Maybe President Carter now is one of the most knowledgeable people of the Palestinian issue, but that happened after his after he finished his presidency, you know, and we're good friends. I remember our debate with him, with President Carter, about the issue of apartheid, which he did not agree with in the beginning. And then after our debates and after he saw the reality, he changed his mind. But in this case, you're talking about a president also who is exposed to other experiences by people like President Carter, by people like Brzezinski, by Scowcroft and others who are talking to him. So he has the knowledge. Now, being sensitive, of course, because what we are talking about here is a situation where Palestinian people are enslaved by a system of discrimination and apartheid. In the 40s and 50s, it looked like it was the Jewish people who suffered a lot from Holocaust and who were trying to find a dignified life, struggling to have a state of their own. Today, they already have a state. They are now the third largest military exporter in the world. They have nuclear heads. They have one of the most powerful armies in the world. They're secured, but they are oppressing other people, and they are prosecuting other people. And these people who are prosecuting Palestinians are not the same people who suffered from the Holocaust, you know. And what I say here is that the fact that their ancestors have suffered does not justify the suffering that Palestinians are subjected to. And you see a situation here which nobody can be proud of, because this is like the last system of racial discrimination and apartheid in 21st century. And I can prove that easily, with facts, with figures, with information.
Sure, it's not the last instance of racial or class oppression in the world.
Yeah, but there isn't any place in the world which is so where apartheid is so systematic as it is today in Palestine. You are talking about Israelis segregating roads. You are talking about a situation where we, the Palestinians, are prevented from using all our main roads because they are exclusive for Israelis and Israeli army and Israeli settlers. This did not happen even during the segregation time in the States. People could not use the same bus or restaurant. But here, you can't use the same road even. I am an elected member of parliament. I ran for president in Palestine. I was second in the presidential race. I was born in Jerusalem. I worked as medical doctor, as a cardiologist, in a very important hospital in Jerusalem for 15 years. And since 5 years, I am prevented, like 98% of the Palestinians, from entering Jerusalem. If I am caught in Jerusalem, I could be sentenced to 7 years in jail. This is unbelievable. You have a situation where a father, a husband and a wife cannot be together. If a husband is from Jerusalem and his wife is from the West Bank, or the opposite, they cannot live together, because if the husband or the wife comes to the West Bank, they lose their ID, they lose their residency. And he cannot, and the wife or the husband from the other side cannot be granted the citizenship in Jerusalem. We've never seen a situation where a country occupies a city like East Jerusalem and then declares the citizens of the city who have lived there for hundreds, some of them families for thousands of years, declares them as temporary residents. And if some of them, if one of them goes out to study in, at Brown for 5 years, for instance, they would lose their residency. What you see are acts of ethnic cleansing. There isn't a place in the world where the officially the policy is, if I have a person with a heart attack and I need to get him to a hospital in Jerusalem or in Israel, I have to get a military permit from a coordinator in the military headquarter, and this can take hours or days, or it could not be granted at all. And then you have, I've had patients die in front of my eyes because I could not get them through the checkpoints. We had 80 women who had to give birth at checkpoints, and 30 of them lost their babies. To me, the fact that a woman cannot give birth in a dignified manner and having to give birth in front of foreign soldiers out in the street is equal to the utmost injustice. Tell me, where does that happen anywhere in the world? And this is happening by a country that is claiming that it is a democracy and that it is civilized. And by people who have had suffering in the past. I mean, that's what amazes me, you know? People who understand how terrible it is to be discriminated against.
Dr. Barghouti, speak of the change in American awareness as you tap into it. Because it's your job to change the American awareness. But I wonder, what's happening over 20 years, over the last year?
A lot of change. The first time I visited the States was in 1988. That was during the first Intifada, and we spoke at different medical schools in the United States. We gave like 46 lectures in 1 month, you know. And that was my introduction to the United States. I've never been here before. Since then, I've come many times. And, you know, in 88, it was better than in the 90s, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. The receptiveness of the people during the first Intifada, which was mainly nonviolent by Palestinians, was much better than what happened later in the 90s and during Bush time. I mean, that was the worst time, probably. Because there was an alliance between neocons and Bush.
I think of Clinton time.
Yeah, still, there wasn't that receptiveness because we had, I mean, this is very complicated, but today I see a big change, better than what we had in the 80s. And I think what you see today is, first of all, better understanding of the Palestinian issue. A tremendous change happened after the war on Gaza. And yes, after the Goldstone Report, who's, as you know, a highly respected Jewish judge who did very good job in Rwanda against massacres there and in Yugoslavia. And by the way, he was praised highly in Israel, and they were very proud of him before he wrote his report about Gaza.
He did a pretty good job, though, knocking it down, not substantively, but sort of discrediting it as a byword in the popular press in this country, I'd say.
Of course, but that's the work of the Israeli lobby.
Sure.
That's the problem of the United States, that you have media that does not allow you to know the truth. You have a media that is skewed to give you the Israeli narrative. And it is very hard to penetrate that media. Even, I mean, when you have like breakthroughs, like my appearance with Jon Stewart in The Daily Show.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. It was criticized heavily. I think Jon Stewart was subjected to huge pressure not to have that interview, you know. But he did well, and he showed it, which I appreciate. But apart from these, I mean, like little and rare breakthroughs, you hardly see anything that reflects, for instance, the Palestinian narrative in the American media. You see a certain narrative that is dominant, and that narrative is preventing the Americans from having what is their right, which is the right to know, the right for knowledge, the right for... And when I go to campuses and speak, I never encounter, like, big objection, because I try to speak objectively. I tell people I am not neutral here. I'm, of course, defending the Palestinian rights. But I try to be objective. And I think when people see the objective reality and truth, they receive it, because people are good. Americans are good human beings. They don't have the knowledge. They don't have the knowledge, and they need to know. And that's where the change is happening, through certain things that Israel cannot stop. You know. And what is very helpful to us, I must say, is the fact that we do have allies now in the American Jewish community, like J Street Group. Finally, unfortunately, while in the 80s in Israel we had a strong peace camp with whom we were cooperating, today much big parts of the Israeli society is benefiting from the apartheid and discrimination system. But who are coming to help? It's the American Jewish community, or the Jewish community in many parts of the world, who are totally incapable of comprehending these severe violations of human rights and basic international human rights principles by Israel.
Surely Gaza at Christmas in 2008, with 100-to-1 disproportion in the killing, looks more and more like a marker of change in the way the world looks at Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. On campuses, anyway, and in many conversations I hear, it's a watershed. What effect does it have in real life, as you see it? The Gaza story in general.
Gaza story was so big that it couldn't be hidden. That's why it was a factor that created a breakthrough in world media and in people's knowledge about the situation in Palestine. Because there were severe war crimes committed in Gaza, including attacking civilians, killing civilians, attacking medical personnel. 16 medical people were killed by Israeli army during the attack, during the war. 4 journalists were killed. Out of the 440 people who died during the Israeli attack, 110 were children. Mm. Young children. Out of the 5,300 people who were injured, almost 2,000 people were children. Nothing can justify killing children in this amount and in these numbers. So besides the fact that it was disproportionate use of force, it was almost unilateral war, because one side had tanks and planes and rockets and guns and all kinds of military arsenal against some fighters. All they had is very, very primitive weapons and some rockets that cannot even be controlled. I mean, very primitive also. So that's why it was totally disproportionate. But most important is that there were these 7 war crimes that were, for the first time in Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, in 1948 there were massacres against Palestinians, but they were not documented. And most important, they were not documented on time. Mm. Today we see war crimes, 7 war crimes that happened in front of people's eyes and were documented and reported, like the use of white phosphorus. When you see the victims of the use of white phosphorus against civilian population, you cannot but get angry. Mm. When you see a child that is totally burned by the white phosphorus, mm-hmm. You see an image of a child who's totally burned by white phosphorus, nothing can justify that. And I think Israel is causing itself big problems because it keeps denying. As many tyrannies in this world, they insist on denying the truth and denying the fact. I was in Gaza 4 days after the war ended, and I saw the people who were killed. I saw the families whose houses were destroyed. We're talking about 25,000 houses that were completely or partially destroyed. People still live there because they have no other place to go to. And since more than a year and a half, when the war ended, Israel is not allowing a single sack of cement or piece of glass to enter Gaza. So not a single house has been repaired. I saw a hospital, Red Crescent Hospital, which was totally, totally burned by Israeli army. I saw ambulances that were completely destroyed. Let me tell you a story of a woman by the name of Samira Baalusha. This woman lived in a house, and she had 5 daughters and her husband and 3 other children. And the daughters were in one room, and she was in the other room. And then the Israeli army hit their house, and she lost all her 5 daughters in one hit, the youngest of whom was 4 years old, and the oldest was 17. There cannot be a bigger tragedy than that. Mm. Not because you lose all your daughters in one hit, but also because, for what? They didn't have to die. They were not on the front line. They were not in an area where fighting was happening. They were inside their home, hiding, like every civilian. Gaza is a very little, tiny place. I don't know if your audience knows that, but you're talking about a place that is only 140 square miles, very small, with 1.5 million people living there. This is the most densely populated area in the world. And when you send F-16 jet fighters, American F-16 jet fighters, throwing bombs everywhere, of course, so many civilians would be killed. I've seen a father who told me the story of how he was with his 2 sons in a car, and then they were hit. They didn't know that the army was coming in. The army hit them. His 2 sons were injured. He was also injured lightly. And he tried to alarm the army that he has injured people, so they started shooting at him. He had a mobile phone, and he called ambulance services. And they received his call. But the Israeli army would not let any ambulance get close to them for 24 hours. And he described to me how for 24 hours he watched both his children, both his sons, they were not children, 18 and 20, I think, both of them dying one after the other. Tell me, what can justify that? How can one justify that for a father to see 2 of his sons bleeding? They could be saved. Imagine the feeling of a man putting his hands on the wounds of his two sons who are bleeding, and then seeing them fainting away step by step by step by step till they die. How can this be justified? So these war crimes are awful.
We hear more and more of these stories. At the same time, we hear that since Gaza, the feelings in Israel seem to have hardened. The right is stronger. The peace movement is weaker. Also, that the aftermath of Gaza includes a stronger Hamas in the West Bank even more than in Gaza. So
Hamas is not so strong, but Hamas is something that Israel uses to frighten the world. Hamas does not have the majority anymore. If we have elections tomorrow, Hamas will not get majority. But what makes some Israelis angry is that Fatah is not getting any stronger either, you know. Mm. That's because people are upset at both parties, Fatah and Hamas. And that's why they are shifting towards the democratic center, if I might call it so, towards us.
In a lot of quarters, people almost celebrate the fact that the Palestinians are divided. The Palestinians had their own political civil war. If Palestinians, all of them, were free to choose their leadership tomorrow, what would it be, do you think?
What we will have is a political pluralism system. What you will see is something like what you have today in Britain. You will have 3 parties mainly. You will have Fatah, you will have Hamas, but you will have us, the Mubadara, the initiative, which is a very rapidly growing third force.
Tell us about it.
It's a force that we established in 2002. It's the youngest party in Palestine. It emphasizes nonviolence and succeeding in convincing everybody that nonviolence is the right way to go. And it pleases me a lot to see people in Fatah and other parties now adopting the same strategy we are proposing. It's also a party that believes thoroughly in democracy and that Palestinians are entitled to democracy and nobody should appoint for us our leaders. We should choose them and elect them ourselves. And we should have a true democratic, pluralistic system like everybody has. And also it's a party that believes in social justice. So for us, there are very important social issues besides the right of Palestinians to be free and our right to end occupation and apartheid. We have very, very big emphasis on issues like the rights of students to have loans to finish their education. We have proposed a law on a student loan fund, which up till now the Palestinian government is refusing to pass, but we're pressuring them. We have very important contribution to how the health insurance system should be in Palestine. We have very clear propositions about social justice issues and care for people with disability and people who are underprivileged. So what you talk about here is the rise of a much more a mature political party that does not only talk about ending occupation and it does not only talk about Israeli-Palestinian relationship, but also it talks about Palestinian-Palestinian internal relationship and what kind of a state we should have, what kind of a system we should have. And it is attracting a lot of attention. We, in most recent elections in universities, we started to make big progress and gaining seats. And I believe that this is the future. Many Palestinians are sick and tired of this fight between Fatah and Hamas because they see that these two parties, regardless of their differences, are fighting for power more than principles. And what Palestinians need today are groups that emphasize principles like I've been describing. So there is a change happening there. And that's why I say nobody should frighten us with the issue of Hamas. Hamas is also developing and changing. I remember my dialogues with them, and I think I believe in dialogue with them. I remember when I used to tell them about nonviolent resistance that they would make sexist comments like, you're talking about women's struggle that you are doing. Mm-hmm. And when I led a team with other international activists, Nobel Prize winners, when we took a ship from Cyprus to break the siege on Gaza because we could not reach Gaza any other way, and challenged the Israelis and risked our lives and reached Gaza, I thought I saw a big change even in Hamas. Suddenly, many of their leaders started to realize that this is an effective way. And I think this change is happening. So I believe, I personally mediated the first national unity Palestinian government. And I was promised then by many foreign ministers in this world, including Condoleezza Rice, that they will recognize the national unity government and deal with it, although they would not deal with Hamas. But unfortunately, after we formed our unity government, Israel managed to mobilize a total embargo on it, which created later the division. So if somebody is happy that Palestinians are divided, then this somebody does not want to see peace, because only a group that can negotiate on behalf of all Palestinians can make peace. And one more thing I've always said for many years, the peace will happen between two democracies. The only peace that can last in a conflictive situation like the one we have is peace between two democracies. And the examples of history from Europe are very powerful proof to that.
What is the Barghouti line or the initiative party line on Saddam Fayyad and all the economic initiatives, the small business growth initiatives that we read about, especially in the New York Times?
Well, we support some of the reforms he's doing. And I just met him, 2 days ago. We meet regularly every month, and we coordinate and we help him sometimes on certain things. But we also, while we do that, we don't think this is alone enough. You cannot speak about economic development in a place where 60% of the people live below the line of poverty. And how can you speak about growth when Gaza Strip has minus growth? When people in Gaza do not... what kind of economic development we're talking about when, people in Gaza do not have a single place where they can have drinkable water? All the water in Gaza today is polluted. It's not drinkable by World Health Organization standards. Mm. So people are, people in Gaza get sick and gradually, and it's a slow sickness. Through drinking this terrible water, which is highly salinated, polluted in many places, with very high concentration of certain minerals that can destroy the kidneys. There is improvement in certain things, but this is not the substitute. You cannot speak about true economic development when you are under occupation, when you cannot have free export or import. Much of the growth in the West Bank is related to the big amount of financial aid that is coming from foreign countries. And there are things we agree with, like financial reform, fighting corruption, that's for sure. But I do not agree with the policy of the Palestinian government when it allocates 34% of the budget to security apparatus and deprives certain very important sectors like health and education and agriculture from needed budgets. 34% is not for security, is not a budget that can be tolerated by any country in the world. Mm-hmm. Soviet Union could not do that, So there is, and that's what we discuss, that's what we talk about the need for reform and about the need to have democratic free elections as soon as possible, and about the fact that we cannot have true economic development if we are totally dependent on financial aid from other countries.
Dr. Barghouti, you're speaking of a vision of democracies cooperating someday. In the meantime, you're talking boycott, divestment, sanctions. By whom? For how long? To what end?
First of all, let me clarify one thing. Nothing from what I'm telling you is against Jewish people or Israelis as people. I don't see this conflict as a conflict between Palestinians and Jewish people or between even Palestinians and Israelis. I see it as a conflict, as a struggle of people who are seeking freedom and justice against oppressive system, definitely controlling the government of Israel today, controlling the political system in Israel today, which is hurting the future of both Palestinians and Israelis. I see an apartheid. And I see that this Israeli system would have never been able to develop or survive if it wasn't for foreign aid from the world community, especially the United States. Israel receives officially from the United States more than $2.5 billion every year. That makes Israel the largest recipient of American aid in the whole world. But Israel receives more than $7 billion other dollars from your taxpayers' money that comes through associations and NGOs and that are tax deductible. And that makes it like $10 billion every year. Without that, Israel would not have been able to do what's doing. Israel also received from the United States the American technology and was of military equipment, and was allowed to develop military industry, and was allowed by United States to sell military equipment with American technology to countries at much better conditions and lower prices than the United States does.
To whom, for example?
To India, for instance. There are military equipment that India cannot buy from the United States because of certain restrictions, but they can buy the same American technology from Israel without these restrictions. And that has made Israel now the third largest military exporter in the world. They surpassed Britain last year, they surpassed France this year, and I bet you they will surpass Russia next year. They sell about $7 billion worth of military equipment to other countries all of this is not possible without American help. So in this situation, we ask ourselves, how do we make the Israelis change their mind? How do we convince them to stop the oppressive system which is hurting our future and their future? Because a conflict continuing will eventually hurt both people. There are two ways. We have to make their system of occupation painful, and we have to make their system of occupation costly. This can be done only through two ways. Either you turn to violence, which I totally disagree with, I don't believe in, and I think it's counterproductive, or you turn to nonviolence and mobilizing international pressure on Israel, as people did in the case of the apartheid system in South Africa. If it wasn't for the divestment sanctions campaign in the 90s and 80s, we would never have seen the apartheid system fall apart in South Africa, simply because the balance of forces between the regime and the people is so big in the interest of the regime. And we have the same situation in Palestine. That's why I speak about divestments and sanctions to encourage nonviolence. This is the only way that we make nonviolent resistance succeed, by having an international component, and especially in the United States. We are not talking about boycotting Israel or Israeli people. We are talking about boycotting occupation. We're talking about boycotting and divestment from occupation and military industry that is exploiting people, that is destroying people's lives, and that is consolidating an apartheid system. So we are calling for divestment from occupation and from apartheid and from injustice.
The fate of Israel-Palestine lies in so many ways in American opinion, which is, as you say, changing, but ultimately in the hands of an American president, too. What is your estimate of Barack Obama in this enormously charged and pressured and historic situation?
As I told you, I mean, many of my friends and colleagues and even foreign friends used to say that I was over-enthusiastic about Barack Obama. Which is true. I think I was very, when he was elected, but like many people here in Rhode Island, I guess. I mean, there is a difference between expectations and reality today. But that element of enthusiasm to him did not disappear in my case. I know he has to compromise. I know he has to act as a politician. I know he's dealing with a very big and difficult establishment. But I know he's better off today after passing the bill in the Congress about the health insurance system. He's more powerful than before. I think after...
Would you have voted for that? You're a doctor. Would you have voted for that healthcare system?
And more. And more. I would have even suggested some changes that makes it better. But yes, sure. Because you see, it's amazing how people don't see this in the United States. You're spending your money for, you're giving your money to the companies that are making profit.
Oh, we know.
And you are not spending it on improving people's health. That is the problem. You have a country that has the most sophisticated biomedical technology in the world, best hospitals in the world, and you are unable to... We in Palestine, with a GDP per capita of $1,000 per capita, treat women's health better than you. Hmm. We have much better primary health care system to deal with diabetes and hypertension than the one you have for people. I'm talking about primary health care level. Hmm. Why? Because we've managed to invent, under most difficult circumstances and with very limited resources, a fascinating primary healthcare model that deals with people's needs at very primary level. We don't think that everything has to be done by a medical doctor. I mean, we've invented a fascinating model of women health workers. We've invented even a new model of women doctors, who are general practitioners trained for 6 months to be women doctors, because simply we don't think that at primary healthcare level a woman doctor has to perform cesarean section, you know. Mm. So there are lots of models that you can, I hope, you can benefit from in the United States, and the value of them that they are not costly.
When I come to the West Bank, would you take me to an ideal clinic?
Oh, yeah, with pleasure.
Where would it be?
We can go to, in Hebron, in Ramallah, in Nablus, anywhere. We have a system that is covering the whole country now.
So meantime, back in Washington, we have a president who's been strengthened by passage of even a flawed healthcare system. Now what on the Middle East?
Now he has, I don't know, I don't want to interfere in United States policy internally, but he needs to make some changes inside his own administration if he wants to go forward. He has better situation in the Senate and the Congress than his predecessors because now Israel is unable to mobilize as it did. Israel still has a majority, of course, but not that absolute majority that it had before. He has allies who can help him, like J Street Group and Jewish groups in the Congress. And I believe he has to make certain changes in his own administration and just go forward. And if there is a person who can do it, it's him. Now, will he do that or not? I don't know. I know one thing is that we are trying to help him. We try to help him by talking to people in the Congress, in the Senate. I'm going to see some of them when I go to Washington in next week. And we are trying to help him by also mobilizing public opinion in the United States. And it's hard work. One has to understand one thing that probably is not well known here. We are just about to lose the last chance for two-state solution. Which means what? It means either there is an American pressure on Israel immediately, and then Israel is obliged to abide by international law and end occupation, and then we have two-state solution. Or that will be lost. I'm not talking about years. I'm talking about months and maybe days. And if settlements continue to grow, then that's the end of two-state solution, which would not mean we're going to give up. But what will happen is that you will see us as Palestinians struggling against apartheid. Increasingly, people understanding that this is a truly apartheid discriminatory system against Palestinians. And a struggle which will only have one end, which is one democratic state with equal rights for both people. But it would be long.
Can you welcome the prospect that at the end of an apartheid struggle, the Arabs and the Palestinians would have a majority in a new Israel, even as blacks have the majority in the power in South Africa today?
That's what many Israeli leaders are afraid of.
Of course.
And that's what Yehud Barak spoke about, the defense minister of Israel, in his last speech in Herzliya. He said, if we don't allow a Palestinian state immediately, we will end up like an apartheid. I say he is already in apartheid. That's the only difference between me and him. And it is already a system of apartheid. And many of them are afraid that if we have truly democratic system, there will be eventually a Palestinian majority. But I don't see it this way. I don't see it as a majority for Israeli Jewish people or a majority for Palestinians. I see it as a different system where both Palestinians and Israelis can live together with equal rights. Today in South Africa, of course, the majority, we're not talking about a similar situation like South Africa, because there you're speaking about, 40 million people versus 10. Here we're speaking about almost equal numbers. We're equal in numbers. We might be in 20 years from now like 5% more or 10% more, but we're almost equal. And I think of a situation where we will share things like we did before the rise of the Zionist movement. Palestine never had a problem between Jews and Palestinians. We always had this very harmonious situation before the establishment of Israel between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And you know that Palestinians are both Muslims and Christians.
Of course.
20% of Palestinians are Christians. And we had a very good harmony. It was only when Britain made the Balfour Declaration and the rise of the Zionist movement that you started to see a change. And the problem with the Israelis is that they want an exclusively Jewish state. This is incompatible with the 21st century. Nobody can say today in the United States, I want an exclusively white state, or I want an exclusively Protestant state, or I want even an exclusively Hispanic state in California, let's say. It doesn't work. Nowhere in the world today you can speak about this kind of exclusivity, because we're talking about globalization. And that's why when you see one country coming out and saying, I want it exclusively Jewish, it doesn't make sense. And that's why I see the future, even if we have two states, let's say we have a Palestinian state and an Israeli state, this will make many Israelis calmer, because they will not be afraid about the Jewish nature of Israel as a state, although 20% of its citizens are Palestinians, as you know, today.
Yes.
But eventually there will be cooperation between the Palestinian state and the Israeli state, economically, let's say. I don't see a problem with us and Israel joining the European Union together, for instance. But Israel has to answer a bigger question, and I think that's what Edward Said related to, and Noam Chomsky and others. I mean, Israel is not an island in the ocean. Israel is an island in the Middle East. So Israel has to have normal relationship with Egypt, with Syria, with Jordan, with Iraq, with Iran even, eventually. What we had so far is an Israeli government that is always in conflict with others. They seek conflict, in my opinion. First, and they use this conflict to justify oppression of Palestinians and to justify lack of solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. First, it was the Soviet Union. They could not make a solution because a Palestinian state would be closer to the Soviet Union, for instance, or with Egypt, which was at that time closer to the Soviet Union. Then it was the problem of Egypt and Syria. And then they had peace with Egypt and ceasefire with Syria. They had a problem with Iraq. Today they speak about Iran. Tomorrow, if Iran is no problem, they probably will start speaking about Azerbaijan. They keep looking for an external justification for a problem that is internal. And that's where I think many Israelis speak about this, and they ask this question. In a global world where you have economic cooperation, why Israel does not want us to be a democracy? Why they don't want us to be a democratic system? Why did they kill twice already our best experiences in developing democratic systems? Once in 1976, when we had the first municipality elections, and they didn't like the results of the elections, and at that time there was no Hamas. As a matter of fact, at that time Israel was cooperating with Islamic parties against the secular national democratic groups like us. And then they killed the results of the 2006 elections, which were praised by the United States and world community as the best democratic election in the Middle East. Why, you see, I see racism here. Why Israelis are entitled to democracy and Palestinians are not? Are they afraid of us being a democracy? The question is, why are they afraid of us being a democracy? Because then we will have a government that cannot be manipulated?
Mustafa Barghouti, can you imagine an Israel, let us call it a Hebrew republic, which is Jewish in culture and its history, its identification, but not exclusive, and is constitutional with equal rights for all? It is Jewish in the way France is French, but it is not exclusively Jewish. How long would it take to get to that sort of place? And would it work in your view?
It would work if Israel gives up two things. First of all, if they give up their military role as a structure that keeps interfering in other countries' affairs. And it would work if they accept the very basic principle, which in my opinion, the key to solution in Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And that is accepting us as equal human beings. Equal in rights and equal in duties. I'm not demanding here equal rights without equal duty. I'm saying we should have equal rights and equal duties.
Duties meaning what in this case?
Duties abiding by the law, respecting the law, not to attack people, not to kill people, not to practice terrorism, if you want, by both sides. But I cannot comprehend a situation where if a Palestinian is using violence, he is a terrorist, and if Israeli's army uses terrible violence against the whole population, that's justified. It has to be equal. We have to have equal rights and equal duties and a rule of law that applies to everybody. You see, eventually, they have to accept the fact that neither of us can control the other. We have to find a solution, and there can be solutions. I don't know how soon this will happen, but I believe in the vision I have that eventually this is what's going to happen.
Come back to the United States and to Americans, if indeed it's up to citizens, popular opinion here, and especially the President and the Congress to find a better way.
The United States has the greatest responsibility because it is the biggest supporter of Israel. Without American support, Israel would not be what it is today. And without American support, Israel would not be able to continue what it's doing today. So there is a strong American responsibility here. Without your taxpayers' money, what you see today in Palestine would not have happened.
We also like to say, if I may, that we believe in justice, we believe in fairness, and so many polls still show that on this dispute, Americans want an even-handed resolution.
Yes, and more people are saying so because more and more people are getting to know. I have a very good Jewish friend. His name is Daniel Barenboim. He's a fascinating musician. We're very good friends. We did together I work with him in this Barenboim Said Foundation, which he co-founded with Edward Said. And he tells me something. He said what annoys him in Israel, being an Israeli himself, is this lack of curiosity on the side of the Israelis. They don't want to know about Palestinians. They don't want to see what's happening behind that apartheid wall. Mm. This was not the case 20 years ago. And that's why me and him agree, and that's what we did together, a film called Knowledge is the Beginning. So knowledge is the beginning for the United States too. And that's why I'm here sitting with you in Brown, while I am very much needed back here, there in Jerusalem and Ramallah and in other places, because I have big responsibilities there. But I'm coming here to Brown to speak today to people, because I believe that this is as important. And I believe that knowledge is the beginning. And eventually things will change. There is no reason whatsoever for anybody to think that we are different from other people in this world. If India got its independence, if people in South Africa got fairness and got rid of apartheid, if Israelis managed and Jewish people managed to survive the Holocaust, then Palestinians will also become free one day.
Mustafa Barghouti, thank you for a very generous conversation with us. I was moved by the film of the concert at Ramallah. I want to see your movie with Daniel Barenboim too. Thank you enormously for this conversation and for your work.
Thank you. Thank you. Good luck.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.